Welcome to the Competent Pastor Podcast.
A podcast by pastors, for pastors, that starts with one question.
What is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
We're your hosts. I'm Michael Danner.
And I'm Rachel Ringenberg-Miller.
Today we're speaking to Glenn Guyton, Executive Director of Mennonite Church USA. Glenn is an author, advocate for peace, and a follower of Jesus who has built and managed high-performance teams. While he's not speaking, he enjoys cooking gourmet meals, riding his motorcycle down twisty back roads, or singing his heart out while strumming one of his guitars. Get ready for an engaging conversation with Glenn Guyton. Glenn, let's get started by having you tell us a bit about how you came into pastoral ministry, why you care about pastoral ministry and your current role, some of those things.
My journey into pastoral ministry. Well, it's an interesting journey. So, I think, first of all, as we think about pastoral ministry, ministry definitely is a calling. I think it has to be a calling. And some people, like I know some people that wanted to be pastors, and they are pastors. And then there are people like me that probably thought that I was going to be a pastor. I really didn't know what that meant. But then I wound up being a pastor, but it was not my intention to wind up in ministry. I wanted to go to Japan, speak Japanese, and be a business person. That's what I wanted to do. That was my plan. Growing up, at one point I said, hey, I'm going to be a pastor. This is when I was in, elementary school or something. I was going to be a pastor. I was really involved in church. My mother was my first Sunday school teacher, and I was responsible for making the Kool-Aid and the bringing the potato strings. I don't know if y'all know about the potato strings. They used to come in a little cap that came in this little metal box, this metal container. Yeah, so that was my job. I did the snacks for Sunday school. So that was my first foray into pastoral ministries, bringing snacks to the kindergarten Sunday school class. But I said I was going to be a pastor. I have a brother that's 10 years older than me. That's actually a Presbyterian pastor. And so I said I was going to be a pastor. And then I decided, well, these folks don't make much money. I'm not going to do that. And that's true. That, right. It's still true. Right. Pastors don't make a whole bunch of money. So I'm not going to do that. And I went on my life journey. I was always involved in church, went to summer camp, did all those faith formation things that I think lead you to be a pastor. So I did all of that stuff and wound up in the military. Many of you all know I was an officer in the United States Air Force. Again, my plan is to make money. And then I got to Virginia. Saw this girl working out in a gym. Asked her if she went out. She said, no, I go to church. And then next thing you know, I'm a pastor, right? She brought me to Calvary Community Church. That's how I got into the Mennonite world, Calvary Community Church in Hampton, Virginia. But I had been involved in ministry, volunteering in ministry, leadership roles in ministry, like my whole life, literally from the time I was 5 years old, till now. I mean, I've had some kind of role in church, whether it's youth ministry, being a high school student, a college student, sponsoring younger kids. So I've been in ministry my entire life, but it just became formalized in me understanding that call after meeting the lady turned out to be my wife, meeting my wife, and her dad was a pastor, but connecting with Calvary, Bishop Francisco, and really learning about calling, understanding how to apply the word of God to my life, and then saying, okay, this is a calling for me now.
How have you maintained that calling? So now you work for over the last decade, you've worked in denominational ministry, Mennonite Church USA. How does your calling as a pastor influence the way you approach that work?
Man, it's the only way I can keep sane, Michael. That's the thing. Like, if you don't see this as a calling, it leads to some bad stuff. It either leads to you being crazy or it leads to you abusing people. And so understanding that this is not about Glenn is the only way that I can survive and do this, that is something bigger than me. So you look at the biblical stories of people that were called, like David, Moses, and these are all flawed individuals, right? You look at Peter. These guys were messed up, right? So I consider myself part of that messed up crew of folks that God has used. And maybe it's because we know we're flawed. We know that we have issues. And I tell people I really need Jesus. Like, it's some folks that are just really holy. That, hey, I'm just holy. Like, they were just born out the womb holy. Not me. I need Jesus. I need the gospel. I need the accountability that comes with doing something that's greater than myself. And so, yeah, that's it. It's almost kind of like, I feel like I sometimes live my life in reverse, right? That I had this wonderful opportunity to do ministry as I was younger and be connected and find such a wonderful leader like Bishop Francisco, who may be a guest on this one day. And then, you know, now I'm doing some other things, just denominational work, but that pastoral ministry, congregational ministry was a wonderful time in my life. It blessed me and it blessed my family, because we were doing something that wasn't necessarily about us, but it was serving this broader purpose.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, that really kind of leads then into our main question, because at one point you talked about how being a pastor is hard, and mm-hmm. and it is hard. There's so many things that goes into being a pastor, and so it's kind of why we have this podcast. So yeah. The question of our podcast that we'd like you to jump into is this: what is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
Man, that's a tough question, because I think there are a lot of skills that you need. Mm-hmm. But let me start with this. I have this motto that I tell people, and it's in my book that I wrote. I wrote this guidebook for young people. Mm-hmm. And I say that we need to live our lives, but not only that, love the lives that we live. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean when it comes to being a competent pastor? First of all, it's being self-aware, right? Being self-aware of who you are, both your strengths and your limitations. I think that's the first part, is this awareness of self, of who you are in relation to, you know, God's people, to this world. Understand, put yourself in perspective. That's the most important thing. And then from that, I think leads to a lot of other things. First, if you're confident and you know who you are, you're not threatened by anyone else. I had a leader once tell me, well, Glenn, you better watch out for this, it was a younger person. You better watch out for this younger person, right? They may take your place. And I said, hey, I'm never worried about anybody taking my place. Why? Because I know I'm called to be in this position. And if they get better, I'm going to get better. I have a unique set of skills that I'm going to use. And this person, if they have similar skills, well, we don't need to be in the same spot. But if they have a different set of skills, then I'm going to utilize those skills to my advantage. I'm not threatened by a gifted person. I want people to be smarter than me. That's why I have you two on my staff. Both of you are smarter than me when it comes to theology and other stuff and relating to different groups of people that I can never reach effectively. Rachel, you have a voice that I will never, ever have. You have a sense of compassion that I will never, ever have. So I can put you on my staff and you can do that work. And you can go reach that group of people that Glenn will never reach. If I have a theological question, you know, I go talk to Michael Danner. You know, that's my resident theologian on staff. I don't have to be a theologian. I have one. Why do we need two theologians on staff? We need some people that can do practical ministry. And Michael could do this too. But what I'm saying is Michael has a different way of thinking than I do. And mm-hmm. he comes from a different background. And it's invaluable to the work that I do to have a staff person that I know is going to challenge me, that's going to talk about me. That's going to question the things that I do, because it makes me sharper. That's it. That's all part of that. And the same thing with you, you know, Rachel, you know, sometimes I say stuff to you and you probably think like, this man is crazy. Why is he saying this to me? But it gives me a different perspective of how the things that I say and the things that I do, how it lands with different groups. And so part of that, again, is understanding who you are. I know who Glenn is. I know my limitations. I know my strengths, and I try to stay in my lane and not get in the way. And I think a good leader learns how to empower other people, brings in a diverse set of skills and talents to enhance what's going on in a community that they've been, you know, they're responsible for.
Yeah, I was thinking about how you were talking about being confident in your call and being self-aware. And it made me think of conversations that I have with pastors who, at the beginning of their ministry, they did feel like they were deeply called to the work. And then mm-hmm. something happened in their ministry and they started questioning if, in fact, they really were called for ministry. And I'm wondering if you ever had an experience like that, or what you would say to a pastor who went in really strong, but then had some things happen and was trying to figure out how to kind of how to build that confidence back
up. I question my call every day. I think that's healthy for you to examine yourself and examine what's going on. But that doesn't mean you should be fearful, right? I always lead like, hey, they'll fire me, right? You can get fired. Like, I'm not worried about my job. I'm not worried about what you think of me in this sense. I mean, I do care about people's opinion, but I don't care in the sense that I'm going to lead in a way that dishonors me or my gift. There's a quote from this movie, Along Came a Spider. It's like my favorite quote, where the detective was talking to Jesse. He said, you do what you are, Jesse. And she said, you mean you are what you do? He said, no, you do what you are, that you're born with a gift. If not, you find something to do and you get good at it along the way. And what you do, you don't betray. Like, you don't betray your gift. And that's the thing with pastors. If they're going to fire you, you might as well, be ready for that. Get fired for being you. Don't get fired for doing something that compromises your values and other things. Lead from a sense of who you are. And then you no longer have to be worried about people saying something about you that isn't true, about you breaking some sense of integrity, personal integrity, because that's how you've always led. When I talk to people sometimes, people always say this about leaders. Well, Glenn or whatever the leader is says such and such. And sometimes I sit back and think like, does that sound like something I would say? Yeah, it does. Or no, it doesn't. And so because I've tried to be consistent about the things that I say and how I communicate, it's just easier for me to just to tell the truth instead of lying. It's easier for me just to take responsibility for the things that I say. And if I make a mistake, I make a mistake. But at least it's my mistake, right? I don't try to compromise who I am. So that's part of understanding who I am, understanding my limitations, and then building my leadership style around that. Also building it in a way that I can show empathy in ways that I can do it effectively versus me trying to fit into a mold of somebody else. So I do question things that I do, but part of it is trying to have that sense of who you are and leading that way throughout the process. I think that helps. It makes it easier long term to be in a leadership role.
Can you think of any times or any leaders you've engaged that kind of lack self awareness?
Yeah, you want me to call names? You want me to call names on the podcast?
we'll turn off the recording for that one.
Yeah, what does it look like when you got a leader that's not self aware? Like, what? How's that impact the leadership? How's that impact the community? There's all kinds of ways that does.
But. Yeah, it's a number of ways that manifests itself. I've had some leaders who were so worried about, getting it wrong that they were abusive, right? And so they wouldn't take anybody else's input. That, like, no, this is my show. I'm running this. I'm responsible for this. I said, yeah, dude, but let us help you. We can help you. No, because it's going to be my head that rolls. Dude, relax, chill. We can all help you. If you let us help you, we can bear some of this burden with you. So is that one type of leader that is so insecure or so worried about their own personal reputation that they won't allow anyone to help them bear the burden? And that leader gets to be controlling. They micromanage their teams. They are abusive, and they don't build trust in the organization. So I've seen that in a number of iterations for leaders. Then there's the other leader. Oh, you're so wonderful. Oh, I love you. We're going to do everything. We're a team. Come on, let's make this decision together. And then when things get tough or when it hits the fan, then you can't find them. Oh, that was them. They leave you. They abandon you. So all of that love and care that they had when things were going smoothly, then they abandon you when things get tough. I want you to be my ride or die, to use a colloquial phrase. Ride or die. I want you with me when things get tough too, not only when things are going well. So I've seen leaders that are like that, that don't have a backbone. They don't have a spine. They won't stand up and defend their people. And I'll defend my people. I mean, I don't know if y'all feel that way, but I will defend my people. And if I need to make some correction, we'll correct each other privately, but I want to stand by my people and let them know that, yes, you can make mistakes and I will support you in those mistakes as long as they line up with our common goals, our common vision. But I want you to take some risk. We don't want to play it safe as leaders. Leaders are lead, right? They're out front. So they step out into the unknown in some cases. Now, how far you step out into the unknown will depend on how comfortable you're doing that. But if you're just always playing it safe and you always know what's going to happen, you're not a leader. You're just a manager.
I can think back to, I've been pastoral ministry in some form for about 30 years. And I can think back to early ministry when I wasn't really as self-aware. How did you learn or develop this competency, this ability to be self-aware? Because a lot of times there are a lot of people that aren't even think they're self-aware, but really don't understand even how they're being perceived by other people. You know,
yeah,
that kind of thing. They wall themselves off with a particular view of themselves. And then that they defend that kind of at all cost against any other feedback that might challenge that they're doing a good job, they're making good decisions. That kind of thing. How did you learn that? How did you,
man,
when that happened, like, in your life or where?
Yeah, it's like that song, Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror. I'm looking at the man in the mirror. You know, you got to look at the person in the mirror from time to time and make adjustments based on that reflection. And I'm thankful that I made a lot of dumb mistakes when I was younger. And I know people that try to be perfect and, you know, then they become responsible adults. And then they make a mistake when they're in their 30s and then the whole world comes crumbling down. But I made a lot of mistakes growing up. I almost got kicked out of the Air Force Academy twice. And, you know, my mama had to tell me, hey, baby, you got to listen to what those people are saying. You can't just do what you want. I had to, at the Air Force Academy, we had this thing called training, right? This is where they stand you out in the hall and they yell at you while you quote information. I got trained till I passed out. Why? Because I was being a jerk. And they actually held me up against the wall till I passed out because I treated my classmate poorly because I was all of that. I was the hot leader. You know, I could do everything well at that time. I was the outstanding basic cadet. And I was a jerk because I was listening to people. Hey, Glenn, you need to get your roommate together. You need to tell him what to do. You know, Glenn, you're good at this. You need to shape him up. You know, you need to help him. You need to help him. And so then my response was sending out to my friends. Yeah, my roommate is a piece of crap. You know, he's sorry. You know, he act like he don't know what to do. I need to whip his sorry behind into shape. And that message that I emailed to people, this was early on when email, like, we didn't really know how to use email. At least I didn't. It got sent to everybody in my squadron, right? And so I was embarrassed for one thing. But then, I mean, I hurt this guy's feeling, right? I had some, I was a preppy. So I had been through basic training before. And then, so I was more advanced when I got to the Air Force Academy. And then, you know, and so instead of me being a compassionate leader, I was just a jerk. And I listened to the crowd. That was one of my biggest lessons is, for one thing, is to have empathy and compassion for other people. And then the second thing was, don't listen to what those people whispering in your ear. Because then when it all came down to it, who was passed out on the floor? Me. I was passed out on the floor in my room. And you know who helped me? My two roommates, one of the ones which I had just talked about. All those other people just left me. I'm the one that almost got kicked out of college for that. And so I was like, well, that was stupid, Glenn. You being a jerk. And, you know, all these people that were whispering in your ear, hyping you up, they're not even here. So you're the one that had to suffer all the consequences for that. So that was a valuable lesson I learned at 19 years old. And then I almost got kicked out again for something else. And then I finally figured out, I said, well, Glenn, obviously you can't do dumb stuff and get away with it. So God must be telling you something. Maybe you just need to act better.
Well, also some self-awareness, right? Like you had two experiences of like, oh, wait, did not go well for me.
This ain't working. This ain't working for me. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that self-awareness is key. I mean, we talk to pastors or other conference leaders and about how to help folks kind of, you know, learn how to be self-aware. And I feel like, and I'm wondering if this is true for you, you can't really teach someone to be self-aware. They have to want to do that work for themselves, because it's really self-work to start paying attention about, of how you are. So, curious of how you have kind of worked and grown in that area of self-awareness.
Yeah, because I wanted to, right? I want to be a better leader. Like, I desire to be a better leader. I desire to make a difference in this world. It's, I've been fortunate, though. Like, that's, again, we go back to the calling thing. I've been fortunate to have been mentored by some really good people in my life and that have helped point me in the right direction. And I look at, again, the church that I wound up in. I mean, I could have wound up in a church with an abusive leader, a leader that was all about themselves, all about the money and all these other things in ministry. Because I've been to those churches and I've met those pastors. But I wound up with a wonderful pastor who was self-aware, who was confident. And I sat there and I listened to him. That's one of the smartest things you can do is pick a good mentor. I think we all need someone to help us along this journey. I mean, we're not going to... most of us aren't just going to come out of the womb and just be this extraordinary leader. I saw this this thing on Instagram, this little kid named Miles. He's like seven years old. He's like a musical prodigy, right? He can like program stuff and make music at 7 years old. And I'm 50 and I'm struggling with this guitar. So, you know, you do have the rare, weird individual like this little kid that comes out like Beethoven or Mozart. But most of us have to kind of learn and glean from other people, pick up some things. In order to get better. And I'm constantly trying to be better. I mean, I think any of y'all would say that. I'm constantly trying to learn from other people who are smarter and better than me so that I can be a smarter and better leader. I surround myself with people that aren't like me. I go to places that are outside the scope of my current influence so that I can see what they're doing over there, to see how it relates to what I'm doing over here. But if we just put on the blinders and put our heads down and just stay in our own little small sphere, we're not gonna learn anything. What was the prayer of Jabez? You know, when that was a big thing. You know, enlarge my territory. I embrace that. Yes, God, enlarge my territory. You know, so that I want to learn more. This is such a wonderful big world. I've been all over. I've been to Iceland. I've been to South Africa. I've been to Ghana. I've been all over the place. And I'm like, man, this world is beautiful. Why do I just want to limit myself to this way, this one way of thinking, or this one world viewpoint, when God has created so much stuff?
Mm-hmm. The theologian in me is still stuck on the prayer of Jabez.
I knew that Michael was going to go boom.
Like, my headphones are starting to like smoke. It's like the prayer itself in the Bible, fine. Love the guy. The book.
Not so much. Yeah, I know people wrote the book, but somebody made a whole bunch of money off of that, right? But that's
the point.
Yeah. No, but that idea though of being open and wanting to have experiences whereby you see the world in a way that kind of opens you up, helps you see better, become a better leader, become a better version of yourself. That's the best application, right, of what that prayer is. So
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I think part of it is the more you know, you should realize the less that you know. The older I get, the less that makes sense. My life is getting simpler as I gather more knowledge. I'm all about a more simple understanding of how the world works. You know, when I was a young leader, and now this is a different thing. Now, so I don't think this is wrong, but I'm going to say this is the progression of leadership. When you're a young leader at 20, like you have all this energy, like I'm going to change the world. I'm going to light the world on fire. You know, we're going to transform all of these different systems and fix everything that these old people have been doing. And then you get into your like mid 30s and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to change this nation. You know, we can get a better system for Midnight Church USA. We're going to fix it. We're going to make sure it works. And then, you know, when you get to like in your 50s, then you're like, you know, let's see how this week goes. Maybe I'm just going, can I get this staff, this committee, just working the best that it can be? Like, I just want to change one or two people and my life work will be complete. Like, I think that's the progression of leadership. So
you skipped 40s. That's where I am. I wanted to know what I was supposed to be doing in 40s, my 40s.
40 is rough. 40 is rough because you got too much stuff going on. Like, for most people in their 40s, you're just kind of like, you're married. You've been married for like 10 years. You got kids. You're just trying to survive in your 40s. You know, you're just trying to survive and just make it happen. So
that's fair.
50s, you get a little bit more of a perspective because you get to step outside and stop doing as much as you can, and you can really start leading, I think, in most cases. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, this is all flexible depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. 50s, you get a little bit higher level of responsibility, and you can start doing strategic thinking. In your 40s, you're doing a grunt work. Like, you kind of figured out, like, you got some wisdom. You got some wisdom, but your knees start to hurt a little bit at that time. Oh, I'm sorry, Rachel. I didn't mean to.
You said knee surgery, Glenn.
I know. That was maybe a 40 and slip. But I just finished physical therapy, though. I was working on my knees, too. So, but yeah, you know what I'm saying? 40s is hard. But in your 20s, most of us are carefree. You know, some people do get married at that age, but most are carefree. You out here just living your best life, and you got all the energy. And maybe not as much wisdom and as much patience as you have. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to get there. Because I think about it now, I'm like, man, you ever think about this? This is you all should ask all my old leaders that are listening to this. Would you, in your current role, let the 20-year-old version of you lead and do all the stuff that you did? I think that's an interesting question for all of us. Because sometimes I think about it, I'm like, I don't know why Bishop Francisco let me do all of that stuff. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what I was doing. Now, if he didn't let me do all that stuff, I wouldn't be the leader that I am today. So this is always a toss-up for me. Would I let 20-year-old Glenn, now that I'm 50-year-old Glenn, would I let 20-year-old Glenn do all the stuff that he did? Man, I don't know. I think about it sometimes, because sometimes I think about it, like, I didn't know what I was doing. But now I feel like I know what I'm doing, but I don't have the energy to do as much of it.
Well, that's actually a common thread in our last interview, too, of this idea that you have to have a community around you that's going to take a risk on you and stick with you when you're young and you're doing things and you're not doing it well, like that they can actually steward you. I'm curious about, like, so one of the things that pastors experience a lot of times, and I think a lot of them would say, hey, of course, self-awareness, absolutely. They get into ministry, they're going, then they get their first pastoral review or evaluation, which the congregation probably didn't do terribly well. And all of a sudden you're confronted with this dissonance between how you see yourself in the role and how people are experiencing you. And it can be really difficult. That's when I think a lot of people will say, I don't know if this is for me. I don't know if I should keep doing this. When you realize that the way you think about yourself isn't always the way that other people think about you, it can be really hard. What advice would you have for folks to kind of survive that first contact with the 20% of people? Let's just use 80-20. Let's use the Pareto principle. The 20% of the people that just aren't going to like you in your ministry just because. Like, how do you deal with that? How do you?
Yeah, it's probably a third of the people don't like you. So if you all have any sense of yourself, probably a third of people don't like you or could care less about you. A third will just say, he's good. He's a good leader. He's fine. And then it's another third that just love you. No matter what you do, they're going to pretty much love you. So that's pretty much how it's going to go. And maybe like 2 or 3% just like hate you and 2 or 3% to just love you unconditionally. So just figure that
way.
Yeah. So just figure that out. So I actually more concerned about the people that love me than I am concerned about the people that don't like me.
Yeah.
I always worried that them people that just will follow me regardless are not really helping me. So I think this, so I hate reviews. I do hate reviews because I do think you should have a sense of self-awareness that nothing that happens at the review should surprise you. Now, sometimes people lie and just make up stuff and vengeful people, but you have to have a sense of who you are. That's why I always tell people, this review is not for me. It's for you. Cause I know what kind of person I am. I know what kind of leader I am. I know who doesn't like me. I know the things about me that ticks people off, probably because I have a wife that evaluates me regularly. So, you know, she helps keep me, you know, level headed. And I have kids, you know, they keep you humble, right? But you should be gathering feedback about how you're doing all the time. Don't wait for a review, because then it's a you problem if these things surprise you. You better be communicating with folks all along the way, getting feedback and building in some type of feedback mechanism in your leadership style so that you can evaluate yourself. So if you're caught unaware, then you're probably not doing a very good job of leading. You're not communicating. You're disconnected from people. Leaders, you need all kinds of things when you're a leader, but you need somebody that's going to tell you the truth. So either you've surrounded yourself with yes people, but I can guarantee you, Michael and Iris are going to tell me the truth about my leadership. So again, you have to have people around you that are going to tell you the truth. Then you got to have some people around you that's amongst the people. Because once you get elevated to this leadership status, you don't know nothing. You don't know anything because everybody is talking to you like you're the leader. When I was the number two guy for Mennonite Church USA, I knew everything that was going on with the staff, the temperature of the staff, what was going on in the conferences. Why? Because everybody would talk to me. But they don't want to talk to me now that I'm the executive director. It's a wall of silence, a cone of silence instantly come up. For you all that are younger than 50, the cone of silence was from Get Smart. So that's a Get Smart reference. Yeah. Maxwell Smart, they had the cone of silence.
Thanks,
but they
would tell secrets.
Yeah. All right. I'm with you.
All right. So see, so this cone of silence comes up. And so you have to find ways to get feedback. You have to be intentional about talking to people. Don't say, hey, I have an open door policy. You can come talk to me anytime. No, you have to go and meet the people where they are. You have to go talk to them. You have to go find out what's going on to get that information so that you can be evaluated. But I think people really should have that sense of yourself. You shouldn't be surprised by those things unless your board or whoever's rating you just has no integrity and they just lying to your face. But I find that's rarely the case. I know people that don't like me. I know people that hate me, right? And it didn't surprise me that they hated me.
What I'm thinking about is though this kind of this first encounter between like, let's say I'm a young pastor who thinks I'm really great at pastoral care and I really knock out of the park. I'm really good at hospital visitation. And then you find out that everybody you're visiting is like, this guy stinks at this. Like, so surviving that first kind of sense of like, I think I'm pretty good at this and other people saying, actually, you're not. How do you wrestle with that? So I agree with everything you just said. Like,
that's a good thing. But like, that's a good thing though. If somebody is telling you how to get better, that's
I know
a
it's
good
a good thing.
Thing.
But how do you like? So many times when people do that, they act like they don't know how to.
They
make
like
that
shut
shift.
Down, yeah. And they think, oh, maybe I'm not called to ministry anymore. Yeah. And maybe you say that that person needs to kind of do some inner work to move forward. But also, I wonder, you know, when you talk about mechanisms, like, you know, what does that mean? What does that look like? Are you forming a little group of people to check in with? What does that look like for you?
You should have some, you got to have some connections. But again, maybe my story is a little bit different. I've always had some mentors. You need some old people in your life and you need some young people. I surround myself. I always have an older person that I can look up to that's where I need to be. And then I have a younger person in my life that's pushing me and challenging me to continue to look at things in a different way. So you need that push pull of people in your life. You can't just be on an island out here trying to lead folks. And then if you think you're all that great, whatever, go watch somebody else, you know, go watch somebody else doing what you think you're great at. And you probably figure out, okay, I'm really good at it or I'm really bad at it. And I've had both. I've been in places where I said, man, I thought I was doing a bad job, but I'm fabulous. And then I've been in some other places where I'm thinking like, you know, I'm doing good. And I'm like, man, that person is so much better than I am. Like, I need to do what they're doing. And so again, part of this, and maybe, yeah, so I'm older now, but when you're younger, maybe you resist that sometimes, seeking out that help, but get you a community, get you some old person, wiser person, more experienced person that you just hang out with, have some coffee with, and just walk around with them. You know, we have this thing that's about mentorship, like that it has to be some kind of formal process. And now you got to go watch, you have to join a mastermind. That's fine. I mean, that's good. Masterminds are good, but just hang out with some people. I mean, that's how I learned how to do half the stuff that I did. And just hanging out with Bishop Francisco, right? I didn't even know I was learning stuff. That's the best way to learn. Right. Sometimes you don't even know you're learning stuff. Hey, Glenn, drive me to this meeting. All right. So I drive him to the meeting and we just talking in the car. He telling me stories and we get to the meeting. I'm watching him in the meetings and, you know, then he's telling me stuff after the meetings. You know how much stuff I learned about Mennonite Church USA and the system by chauffeur him around, just sitting in the meetings and just sitting in the back of the room. Sometimes you just need to go sit in the back of the room somewhere and you'll learn something as a younger leader. And then, you know, if you need to go call somebody and ask questions, you can do that. So that process and having these relationships is important for us in pastoral care. Do not try to do this thing on an island. If especially some young pastors have gone and they're in this rural isolated areas, well, you better get written to your contract that you can go fly and meet with some other people, even if they're not Mennonite pastors. Go meet with some other pastors so y'all can just talk and just figure, hey, this is what's going on. What you think about this? This is what I'm doing. And they can say, man, you crazy. Or no, that's, you're doing a good job. But you need to be able to take some criticism. I mean, don't let criticism destroy your world. If everybody's saying good stuff about you, again, that's when I get worried. When there's no criticism or critique of what I'm doing, something's wrong. Either I'm not trying hard enough, or people are lying to me, or something. And so, criticism, bad review, don't let that worry about it. Don't let that worry. You should know who you are, right? And if something catches you off guard, well, you need to work on it. Thank God they told me that. Now I can be aware, just like I was when I passed out on the floor. I said, okay, I'm a jerk. Glenn, you're a jerk. You need to be aware of that. So let's move on and either get better or stay down here on this floor.
I think for a lot of new pastors, part of the anxiety around that whole process is often in churches, like the evaluation or the review at the end of a term is often tied to a vote for continued employment. And so there's a lot of anxiety wrapped up in that in a way that, a pastor once told me that he said he became a much better pastor once he realized another church would hire him.
Yeah. Hey, man. See, that's what I was going to say.
He had the freedom to be himself and to be a leader that took more risk because he realized that his livelihood is not dependent upon this particular group of people liking him.
Right. So just be good. Be make yourself proud. That's the first thing. Make yourself proud of what you're doing. Like, are you pleased with your work? That's really one of the most important things. Now, I'm not saying be arrogant, but just be pleased, like, with the things that you're doing, like what you're accomplishing. Are you satisfied with that? Mm-hmm. What are you evaluate yourself before anybody else does. Okay, what am I doing good? Where can I improve? What are my opportunities for growth? And then if they fire you, they fire you. You ain't making that much money anyway as a pastor. Don't worry about it. If they fire you, go do something else. Somebody will take you. People need pastors. They need leaders. And so if you're good, don't be worried. Now, if you're not good, then maybe you need to be doing something else anyway. Sometimes you're not good and you just need to move on. Everybody that goes to seminary is not a good pastor.
Right.
Yep. You might be in the wrong job. So, but that's for you to figure out. I can't tell you if you're a good pastor or not. I mean, I could tell you if I saw you, but I don't know you.
Gonna reserve judgment.
Yeah, I reserve judgment. And I can tell you if you're a good pastor. You may not be a good pastor for me. You may be good for somebody else. You got to find your tribe, your people, right? Because there's some pastors that wouldn't make it in my context, but they would make it in other contexts. But I think I can pretty good judge of character. Somebody's good. If you're good, I can tell you where you fit. I've been doing this for long enough.
Yeah, I really like your suggestion of having an older mentor, which is kind of like what people think about when they think about mentors, but then also fostering relationships with people younger than yourself too. I like kind of that both and situating yourself, in the middle. That's helpful.
I got like old Michael on this, and I got you. And you're younger, We got Michael representing the old people, and then you got you, this new up and coming group of leaders that I'm excited about.
I'm not that much older than you.
No, I know. I'm just messing. I feel like I'm an old leader, though. I feel like I've been around a long time.
Right.
Like, in this role, this position.
In the church, it shifts, I think, a little bit.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask then, like, in terms of, like, longevity, you've been around for a long time. How do you do that? Mm-mm. How do you keep going?
You need to ask somebody like Iris De Leon Hart showing about that, because I said, hey, Iris, I don't know how you've done it for so long. But I do think the pace of ministry has changed a little bit. I think that, we have so much communication, people have so much access to you that it does get a little tiring. So, one thing I've had to do is give myself permission to disconnect and turn off. I think that's one of the things that young leaders need to realize. You have a life, you have a family. You're on call 24/7, but you can be selective in what call you answer. I think that's the key. Somebody is in a crisis, somebody dies and they need you. Yes, you can drop some things and go there. But if somebody's just your normal issues, they can wait to business hours, or you have someone else on call to help you with those things. And so part of it is giving yourself permission to take time off, because this thing will burn you out for a little bit of money. It's not all about the money, but what I'm saying is people act like they're paying you millions of dollars and they want you to be at their beck and call. That's not really your responsibility as a pastor. You want to make sure people's needs are met, but you're not their personal assistant that they can just reach out and touch you all the time. You need to spend time with your family. You need time to talk to God. You need time to go exercise. You need time to study so that you can be a better leader. So carve out some time for yourself. 8 to 5 is a fallacy. We need to get out that mindset. You don't have to work 8 to 5.
Yeah, I once had someone tell me when I was first starting in ministry, and also I had both of my children when I was a pastor.
Yeah.
And I was feeling very overwhelmed about having to do the ministry work and having 2 small children and a spouse who worked weird hours. And this woman came up to me and she said, you know, as long as you get done what you need to get done, no one cares when you do it. So if you need to do work stuff at home, do that. If you need to do home stuff at work, do that. And that was like a really freeing moment for me to be like, wait, okay, I don't have to like compartmentalize my life in this way. That was, very helpful. And so I kind of hear you saying that to a certain degree too, that like 8 to 5, like for a pastor, that means nothing. Right?
Right.
And so how do you like balance the ebbs and flows of ministry? Because sometimes, you are going to be working like 60, 70 hours. And sometimes, you know what? Maybe you're just working 38. That's fine. It's just so much to balance there and be aware of how to keep your boundaries in that ebbing and flowing of ministry.
Yeah, I think we need to get out of this counting hours thing for one thing, because again, there are some things that you need to accomplish and do, and you know, some administrative things that you need to do and be available, and it needs to be predictable. But I'm reading this book, Reinventing Organizations by Frederic Laloux. And so it's spelled Laloux, but it talks about a different model of leadership, and many of our boards and governing authorities and a lot of local congregations are locked into this hierarchy. You know, you work for us, you answer to us, and this is how things go. And just, I'm the board chair, you're the pastor, you're going to listen to me, and all that foolishness, all that nonsense. We need to understand that we need to start trusting our people to do their work and get things done. We need to be really clear about what our mission is and what our objectives are. And if, as long as people are meeting those objectives, we need to let them be flexible and creative in getting there. And so everyone has a role, but we need to decentralize some of these things. And so you as a pastor, this is from Bishop Francisco, but don't be super pastor. You don't know everything because you went to seminary. You know, we have pastors out here doing marital counseling that have no understanding of psychotherapy or anything else. We have pastors out here trying to give financial advice and they can't balance their own checkbooks. We have pastors out here trying to develop the children's curriculum and they don't know anything about pedagogy. You know what you can do? You can send the people down the street and create a partnership with a licensed clinical Christian therapist to do your counseling for you. You can make a partnership with Everence or a bank or some financial institution to do financial counseling for people. You can go get curriculum and all these things from Mental Media or some other source that are experts. You don't have to do all that stuff yourself. But as the pastor, you may need to coordinate some of these things. You may need to vet some other resources. Stop trying to do stuff you aren't qualified to do, that you don't know anything about. What's your background to be able to give people advice in this area? If you don't have it, again, that's self-awareness. You're not a licensed counselor. Going to seminary does not make you qualified to do marital counseling, especially if you end up being married. That ain't your role. Or if you got a bad marriage, and some of y'all got bad marriages. So don't be trying to tell everybody some other stuff and messing up their marriage. Send them to some qualified people to go get the help that they need. And you've done your job as a pastor.
Yeah. I've seen pastors get caught in that trap where they have to be the solution to every question.
And they can't be okay with not having the answer right that minute, right? Like,
right.
Instead of like, we're going to figure this out together somehow, right? Like,
right.
So maybe a final question. Sure. What do you think? So you've been at this a while. You're a denominational leader now. What, as you look around, what gives you hope for the church, for MCUSA, for however you want to define that? What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. You know, I still just love to see when I go to local congregations and the work that's being done there, like people's lives are being changed, young families, like there's still a place for this, for the local congregation. And I think we need to strengthen that community, but that local community of believers is really where ministry happens, right? So when you're sick, you have someone to come visit you. When your child is born, you have someone to walk alongside you in that community. I love that. So my hope is in the local congregation. I don't want us to discount that. I don't want local congregations to be so caught up in these national politics or what's going on at this church 1,000 miles away. No, I want you to be concerned about the homeless person, or not, we don't say homeless anymore. We would say the unhoused. What do we say? The unhoused people.
Housing
people,
insecure.
Or food insecure people. Yeah. That's what we need to be focused on. And then, you know, the denomination will equip people to help do those things. But that's where the ministry happens. I'm not calling you if somebody in your congregation is sick. I don't know you, but your pastor does. I'm not coming to visit. I'm not flying from San Antonio to wherever you live to visit you in the hospital. But hopefully you have some elders or some deacons or some church mothers or something like that that come by and hold your hand and walk alongside you. That's what I'm excited about. That's what gives me hope. And I think that part of the work that we want to do in Mennonite Church USA is to strengthen that, to strengthen the resources that we provide to the local congregation and allow them to do ministry in context. That's what excites me.